So I feel like my job on this panel is to complement the other papers by hopefully also emphasizing the trouble that we get into when we split human activity into social and economic and pay lots of attention to the economic part and not so much to the social part. But also my job is to tell you a little bit about what a lot of public health advocates have been doing about this, and specifically my case studies are the European Union and the United States. I'm a political scientist, so I'm approaching this very much from a sort of lobbying perspective. So the work today that I'm going to present you is from two sources. First of all, my doctoral research, which was quite recently completed. That was basically taking a look at this kind of advocacy in the European Union and the United States. The data is from a set of interviews with trade negotiators and with advocates in both cases, which lasted between 1 and 3 hours each, and then a set of documents that accompanies that, political documents produced by the governments in both the European Union and the US. Okay. So I have no relationships to disclose, mostly not because I'm virtuous, because nobody gives money to political scientists anyway. Okay. So I'll start by saying the context for this is that I did not choose at any one particular point to come and study health or cross-border health or international public health in any sense. I actually came at this from studying trade policy. I'm a trade policy specialist, if you like. And I eventually found that trade has been encroaching gradually on a lot of health issues that I personally care about. I can kind of give you the list, the quick list. First of all, we've already heard intellectual property and access to essential medicines. Cross-border health services, which is a project I'm doing at the moment, which is scaring me quite a bit, as you can see from this picture. And the effects of those cross-border health services of medical tourism, essentially, on health systems and public health. Third, things like environmental health, the use of chemicals and the regulation of that use. And then also some big health risks, things like tobacco and alcohol and so on. All these things are encompassed in trade policy, and they are the trade agreements that we have currently apply to these areas. And I'm not entirely sure that the current regulatory framework, the current legal framework that we have, trade agreements and related regulatory guidelines, is the best way of dealing with these issues. And I'm going to try and convince you a little bit that you might feel the same after this talk. So the reason for this picture is that my current project is looking at some of the health broker organizations that have come forth in the last few years, in particular, to promote medical tourism from one country to another. Suffice to say, this is just an example of one of the things from that list that I've just reeled off, cross-border health services, and I just wanted to use this to say, explain a little bit about how trade can affect your health. I found it quite disturbing. This is a screen grab just from one of those organizations. You can get this just by searching on Google for medical tourism. This is the kind of organization that comes up. Including, note that you can go and rent a womb at the same time that you are relaxing and having your nice Ayurveda treatment. And also, you can rent a nice white Caucasian womb. I think there's a lot of ethical issues here that need to be dealt with. So the trouble is that there are a large number of unresolved problems arising from the current way that we deal with health across borders. And here's just a small summary of some of these. So even in this one area from my list of trade and health issues, there are a large number of questions that trade agreements just don't answer. They don't really say much about the role of publicly funded healthcare. They don't really say much about what patients might expect or what individuals might expect for some going abroad to receive care. That's apart from the price. They don't really say or explain how we might provide aftercare or follow up on people who've gone abroad to receive a treatment or some kind of wellness treatment and then come home. They don't really say much about what happens if that goes wrong. In other words, who is liable? They don't really say much about what the effects are going to be of greater trade in health on health systems in developing countries. Are we going to see more extensively parallel health systems developing between a sort of medical tourism sector that does not necessarily serve the rest of the population? And a sort of internal brain drain into that sector from elsewhere in those countries. So to summarize here, the point that I'm trying to make is that strong legal frameworks exist. They promote the liberalization of health and wellness services, but the involvement in health of health experts of any kind in these agreements, in the implementation of these agreements, in the formulation of these agreements is weak. And this is my political science side talking, so you can go to sleep during this side if you're not too keen on that. But how do we currently regulate this kind of cross-border activity, this trade in health? Well, as you can see, here's the strong legal framework that's liberalizing trade. Well, one of them is the General Agreement on Trade in Services. We've also heard mentioned the TRIPS Agreement. These aren't the only ones. But look at the other ways in which we try and assure some kind of quality in cross-border healthcare right now. Well, Joint Commission International accredits a large number of hospitals and other medical facilities in lots of different countries. We have a set of international standards that are being applied to health, although they're not about health, they're about management. We have some professional organizations that have tried to come up with some guidelines to protect patients in these circumstances. And the American Medical Association is one of those professional associations, has a two-page sort of guideline. And then things like, if you look at a lot of these health brokers, they have a lot of wide variety of quality marks on their websites. They're very into having a nice icon for you to look at from the Better Business Bureau or the something or other, sort of nice gold standard. So I feel I want to put all of these in the category of quite weak quality assurance. It's about reassuring a consumer that the health experience that they're going to have is going to be a good thing. And it's not very much about actually ensuring quality on the ground or addressing any of the other problems that I've just explained. And the accreditation of hospitals, by the way, is a fee-for-service thing, so there's a conflict of interest here. So I call this private interest governance. PIG is not my acronym, somebody else used this. I'm not trying to be deliberately mean, although maybe I am a little bit. So private organizations assuming functions of government, i.e. regulation, promoting some kind of transnational coordination, but it's in their own interest to do so. This is the way that we are currently regulating health across borders. And I'm not sure that that's good enough. I mean, where else have we seen this kind of regulatory model before? Well, it's finance. And we really know how well international financial regulation has turned out in the last couple of years. So I think it's very important to have public health input into these systems somehow, and I'm going to try and explain some of the ways in which advocates have tried to do that. So on the domestic level, a little bit more than internationally, how do governments really obtain that input? How can they obtain public health input into trade agreements? And there are four main ways. I've put an exclamation mark by committees because I feel as a political scientist, that's all I ever talk about sometimes. First of all, the idea of having specialized advisory committees is to provide, it's because trade's very complicated, ridiculously so. And so governments try to seek out technical advice on both sort of sector-specific issues and sort of trade and issues, trade and environment, trade and labor, for example, but not necessarily trade and health, although I would like that to be the case. Secondly, one of the ways in which governments seek input on trade is through things like legislative hearings, congressional hearings, parliamentary hearings in my other case. So the idea of these is we're trying to form some evidence basis, some basis for public discussion to mandate this whole negotiation process. And that's an opportunity for public health input. Thirdly, there are a number of public meetings. In both of my cases, there's a number of requirements for consultation, for some kind of transparent public forum where people can submit either written statements in some cases, oral statements in others. More often than not, however, this is usually coming from very organized lobbies and sort of very, rather than necessarily the public at large, right? And then fourth, I've sort of summarized this by saying legal language. This also comes in the form of usually legal briefs. As I said, trade is very technical and complex, and the opportunity for organizations to submit these kinds of amicus curiae briefs or other briefing materials is another way to try and get public health in there. So let me go to my two cases. The United States has a system of trade advisory committees that it's had since the 70s. And there's still currently, these 28 committees, and they're sort of in three tiers. There's a number of, there's a very general overview committee at the top, a number of issue-related specific committees in the middle, and then a number of industry-related committees at the bottom. The important thing to note about these is that it's a system where the individuals involved have to get a little bit of extra security clearance, and the idealized bargain is that they should get, in return, some access to draft trade agreements. Whether this always works in practice, I think, is a matter for debate. The trouble with this is that, above all, it's providing legitimacy for what the US government wants to do anyway. You know, it's allowing, we can, the US, USTR, the US Trade Representative's Office, can point to these committees and say, hey, look, we did consultation. We brought in all these different views to try and help make trade less socially unacceptable in the ways that I've described. And that's much more of a benefit to the USTR in some ways than it is to the groups involved always. And of course, the nominations to these committees are political ones. So that obviously is affected by who's represented. For example, if you want to count numbers, there are more representatives of companies who make sort of artificial sweetening products, nice corn syrup products, than there are environmentalists on these committees. And the same thing is the case for public health. So I put few to no, because we've kind of struggled to the point where there are a tiny amount of public health representation on these committees, but for a very long time there was nobody. So at the same time, very heavy representation from big pharma, tobacco, chemicals, and the insurance industry. So it's not necessarily balanced. And there isn't a subject committee on health. Now, my other case, which I wanted to talk about a little bit more because you probably don't hear about this very much, is the European Civil Society Dialogue, which is a very, it's a similar process, although I would say it's much broader in terms of the membership of organizations that are actually involved. And so the idea behind this, it was actually launched by Pascal Lamy, who's now head of the WTO. But back in the days before he went to the WTO, he was doing this. The idea was he wanted to have a broader forum for discussion that could bring lots more different types of groups in to discuss trade and the implications of trade for their various issues. And that does include public health membership. And so there are a number of health-related groups in this forum already. So essentially, the goal that US advocates have been pursuing for a large number of years has been achieved in the EU, but there's a bit of a drawback. It's a transparent forum. It meets very regularly, so 30 to 40 meetings a year. The officials do come, and they do listen. And they do things like the dialogue organized representatives to go to Geneva and sit in on WTO deliberations. So 5 minutes, thank you. The trouble is, as you can see, there's a lot of organizations registered, and only about 38 of them, this core group, that seem to be the participants. Secondly, I think that from my interview evidence and the other data that I looked at, the consensus seems to be that a large number of these organizations have stopped participating because they feel they have a voice there. There is some kind of information exchange going on, but there's not any kind of vote. So they did an evaluation report of this dialogue and said it was entitled A Voice and Not a Vote. So the actual changing of the policy, it has been incredibly difficult to achieve. There have been some successes, notably in the area of access to essential medicines, and some other successes in relating to animal health and food. But not resounding policy changes by any means. So I'll skip that. Really, it's odd because these two cases are a trade-off between slightly greater insider information on the one hand with slightly greater participation on the other. And you might well say, well, that's no good. We want both of those things. At least you certainly would if you were advocate involved in this. And so I feel like the importance here, this is where I'm moving into saying, well, what have groups done to try and negate these effects and what can they do? Well, one of the most important things is to be, as we would say in social movement studies, both inside and outside of the window, right? You have somebody inside who can very clearly articulate your argument. So how does trade affect health? How does health affect trade? What is the relationship there? What is should the policy be? At the same time, that person inside the window can point to everybody else who's outside the window saying, hang on, this is a really big issue. So where groups have been successful, they have followed this insider-outsider strategy. And so you see that in a lot of the access to medicines debates in both cases. There is great use of expertise inside the window and great use of mobilizing people outside the window. So the danger here is that we will get stuck with this top one here, consultation, the exchange of information, which doesn't imply that anybody really has to act on any of these views, right? And hopefully what we might end up with is the bottom one, which is greater collaboration. So some shared responsibility for policy outputs and outcomes. And I think the opportunity here is to get professional networks involved in trying to formulate what should the policy be, what are the norms that the policy should rest upon. If you can do that, good luck to you, but if you can do that, I think that is actually the route to greater success. I don't have much time to talk about this, but this is an EU example, not necessarily related to trade, although it is indirectly related because it deals with cross-border products and cross-border companies. And this was an initiative where these groups do actually share responsibility for policy promises or commitments with EU officials. And so the idea is that they have a sort of peer pressure amongst them to try and force these companies to be more socially responsible, to try and adopt policies which are going to improve these key targets on diet, physical activity, and overall public health. So some of the things that they've been doing are things on food labeling, portion sizes, things like lifestyle programs, the promotion of sports for children, etc. The jury, I think, is still out on how successful this is going to be in the longer term. As I said, this is into its fifth year. But the key point to note is that this activity has been forming a legal basis upon which the European Union could then act. Because if you're dealing with a sort of transnational policy space between countries where no one country has authority, you have to create that legal basis of authority first before you can really have anything to stand on. That's why it's called a platform. So you have that thing to stand on, and then some more actions can come, policy activities can come from there. I'm nearly done. So, above all, the four key strategies for action. The groups that did the best were those that leveraged their expertise. Some very important examples would be environmentalists who were dealing with chemicals and violations by certain companies, and they were trying to team up with teams of scientists to actually report this and present their evidence in a very scientific way, and come across not as advocacy groups outside the window, but come across with people who also had, here is our potential solution, here is the thing, the policy that we recommend. This is our evidence base for saying that you need to change what you're doing. Secondly, collaboration across issues. When groups got together and formed rainbow coalitions, they were much more successful, and when groups like trade unions split off from others, they were much less successful. Thirdly, transnational networks has been incredibly important in these international meetings, which are such big venues for trying to get public health attention, get attention to public health issues in trade. And so what you can do there is have people on either sides of the border, either sides of national borders, saying this is a common area for all of us. And finally, transparent public debate, that outside factor, standing outside the window. So I feel, if you remember anything from this presentation, two things. First of all, it's about creating a legal basis for action inside the window. And secondly, it's about critical mass outside. Thank you.
Well, that was a good panel, wasn't it? Questions of the panel? Comments? Yes.
Hi, I'm Brett Visible, and I work for International SOS. We are the world's largest medical assistance provider to multinationals. We've dealt with pretty much every topic you've raised. We do health impact assessments for the extractive industry, so we're involved in that. We purchase a lot of medications in developing countries. We are a big organization. We also clean up the mess when people get stuck in countries after medical tourism, where we have all the air ambulances that come pick you up, take you back home. And we also consult on CSR, and also run into problems with transplant traffickers. So we've dealt with all of it in all different countries. The question I've got is more on the Trade and Health Forums. This is the first Trade and Health Forum session that I've been to. Does the APHA make an effort to reach out to multinationals or corporations as part of the Trade and Health Forum? Because quite often, in fact, every session I've ever been to in any public health conference that talks about trade and health or public-private partnerships, I'm the only multinational representative in the room most of the time. So are there mechanisms that you're using to reach out?
You have a question? The young lady works for a multinational corporation, wondering if APHA and Trade and Health Forum involves corporations. And, well, we're a membership organization,
yeah.
And if you and your colleagues want to join,
I am a member, but it's hard to get multinationals involved. And we know, because we sell to multinationals. I mean, we sell to non-programs. And getting them motivated is hard. But if you're talking about trade and health, it's really hard to have the conversation without the other side present. So I would say, beyond just saying they can be members if they want, because I'm a member, but I'm a member because I'm a PhD student doing public health.
Okay.
Beyond that, it might make sense to reach out to them in their own forums. They have their own conferences. So the ICMM, the mining represent, basically the Association of Mining and Minerals, they have just released their health impact assessment guidelines. That's an ideal place to go and reach out to them if you're talking about the impact on indigenous populations, because from what I recall in those HIA guidelines, I'm pretty sure they put something in there on indigenous populations. But it's going out to their conferences as opposed to expecting them to show up at your conferences.
Do you want to comment like that? Go ahead.
My answer is that I will tell you in 2 years. I'm just starting a research project, actually, that's funded by the National Science Foundation. And part of what we're trying to do is that exactly, and
yeah.
Have a joint forum. And I will tell you how successful it is as we go along. I hope I can tell you that it's very successful, but part of what we're trying to do is get corporations and everybody else in the same room, deliberating, discussing, and so I'm hoping that it's going to be successful going forward. So that's exactly
what sounds great. I mean, I know it's really hard to get corporations and NGOs to speak the same language, and we often get stuck in the middle because we've got a little bit of both. But good luck, I hope it goes well.
Thank you.
I think, can I just respond to that? I think one of the other things it's important to bear in mind is in terms of input into creating trade policy in the US, multinationals are way overrepresented versus public health groups. So I think that the idea, sort of power that resides with that position that multinationals have, the idea that mostly under-resourced public health people should have to go and search out those forums is maybe a high demand. I think that there's made perhaps a more important place for developing those dialogues is by bringing public health people into public decision-making forums that are currently, in which currently multinationals are overrepresented.
Definitely, although you might find that if you went to see the multinationals in, on their own turf, so to speak, they get a bit scared of going to other people's turf. But if you went to see them on their own turf, you might find it easier to get into the public forums, because while the multinationals think that you're opposing them, they'll just put their foot down and say, we don't want their representation on the public forum, and we have the majority vote, so they can stay out. But what you find inside multinationals, there are some people there that are very open to the cause. So we sell public health programs, we convince people to do health impact assessments online, and it's a few people, and you can find them at these meetings, and they might soften it to make it easier for you to get more representation on those committees.
Mm-hmm. Eric, do you have a comment?
Well, just, I mean, there's a whole cottage industry of social corporate responsibility where there are dozens of conferences every year where corporations and NGOs, you know, do the dance. And frankly, the health destructive policies of corporations are not a result of their lack of familiarity with the NGOs or the points of view. It's other issues. So I don't really think it's a problem that corporations have never heard a public health point of view. It's just there are other issues which corporations put first and foremost, which run counter to that. I think one of the great examples of how CSR is really a blunt and ineffective implement and human trafficking as well as occupational safety and health is what I do is the case in Malaysia a couple of years ago where there were two factories, one run by Nike contractor, the other run by a Disney contractor that had head workers from Vietnam and Burma who had paid large amounts of money in recruitment fees, which of course were against the codes of conduct of their companies. And when they arrived in those factories, the contract manufacturers confiscated their passports, so they were unable to leave these factories. And it was only found out subsequently because the family members in Vietnam and Burma complained to their governments, which then contacted the Malaysian government. And most interesting thing about it, though, is that this Nike factory, Nike contract factory, had had a relationship for 7 years, and it had been audited by third-party auditors and their own people for years and years and years, and they never caught this. And Disney factory didn't even know that that factory was in its supply chain. And it shows that whole concept that, you know, that the CSR programs on a top-down management system, global level, can actually see what's going on in the supply chain is very dubious. And so I think it's an interesting, I hadn't thought of human trafficking in the way of these global supply chains the way that you would present it today, but that's very interesting. And of course, recruitment fees and confiscation of passports in addition to whatever working conditions are in the plant are a perfect example of human trafficking.
Well, and as part of what you point out too is that the goals of public health and corporations are fundamentally different. And the corporations have their legal mandate of what they do, what they're supposed to do, and public health has a very different goal. And those are coming to conflict very frequently. Corporations, by nature, that is, and I'm not talking about nature, their operations, their practices, their policies, they're fundamentally, they have to sort of offload or externalize all the costs that they possibly can. And those externalize to society, whether it's a pipeline coming out the back of a factory dumping some chemical into the river, or medical care for employees, insurance, is pushed off onto government. So that makes it very difficult to have these kind of sort of negotiations as well as the power imbalances that Suzanne talked about.
Yeah,
mean, I think it's a good point that there may be some demonizing multinationals that goes on, and I mean, I think I've seen that in the debate over intellectual property in developing countries, because there's a lot of intense rhetoric about what the impact these rules is doing. You know, like Guatemalan children are going to be dying on the street because there are patents that, you know, may not be matched by reality. And I actually did meet with Fetty Pharma, which is sort of the representative of multinationals in Central America, while I was there, and that was informative to hear their perspective. But I do think that it is kind of a fundamental conflict, because as we've been saying, multinationals, they have, you know, these special, you know, they have shareholders, if they tend to be corporations, which they usually are, and they have duties to maximize, you know, shareholder value. It's just such a fundamental conflict. I mean, in theory, you know, they could argue that they would be derelict in their duties, that they were really, you know, taking these public health objectives in the same way as representatives here. It's so hard to reconcile that I don't know. Yeah, when you get them in the same room, it doesn't always seem to be.
What I think is interesting is that historically, though, the mantra that corporations mainly exist only for the shareholder is a pretty recent phenomenon. I mean, that's Milton Friedman in 1962 talking about that the only obligation is to maximize profits for shareholders. But if you actually look historically in the business and management literature, there is a large contingent of management scholars who will point to the fact that corporations exist at the request of society rather than vice versa. So it's not as though, I mean, if you take a long historical view on it, it's not as though this can't be turned around to be more for social benefit than for shareholder benefit. So it's interesting.
Well, I would argue that during the first 100 years of the United States, it was that way. Mm-hmm. They were specifically chartered for a particular purpose to serve society, like a bridge, mm-hmm. railway, a toll road. But over the last 100 years, through ruling of the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. that really has changed. And in fact, not the Supreme Court, but a court actually mm-hmm. ruled in favor of the stockholders when they sued Henry Ford mm-hmm. for selling his vehicles too cheap, and they were losing money.
Right.
So that is a precedent, not just since Milton Friedman. Mm-hmm. That's been going on for the last 100 years through one court ruling after another in which the rights of corporations have been expanded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, on a policy basis, that mm-hmm. certainly could be reversed. At least on a legal basis for some U.S. corporations, mm-hmm. the legal environment at the point is that that's how their duty, they have these fiduciary duties, the
right.
shareholders and directors and officers to be personally liable for
right.
putting that second.
Well, it's not just U.S. law, it's internationally, in the WTO rules, people are non-existent most of the time, right? Corporations are represented quite well.
Question?
I think when dealing with multinationals that might be behaving badly, one thing you need to really think about is how do you make it in their best interest. I've been working on IP and access to medicine since for years, and yeah, a lot of demonization, a lot of actual misogyny too, but like in 1999, no one was being demonized, and of course of AIDS medicine was $10,000 per patient per year, and next to no one was on treatment in the developing world. The government's actually demonized more than the companies, and that was all over IP things. But once, after Clinton did a 180 after being demonized, then there was generic competition, and all of a sudden, the companies had real competition, and now they also sell drugs at much lower prices. In most cases, the Indian generics still undercut, but not all. Like, if you want to buy Clatra, in most places, the cheapest place to get it is from Abbott. And that's been through like a lot of pressure to make it in their own best interest. And I don't think that without both economic pressures and some PR pressures, but they backed off the Brazil dispute because of trade pressures. They had not done so in Thailand. They lost the PR battle with AIDS in South Africa when they were suing Nelson Mandela. But I mean, I think a fair amount of demonization in certain situations is necessary, but also thinking about how to change the structure, in this case, through generic competition, but like say in mining, if there's bad mining practices going on in certain places, you could conceivably probably have to do circles around WTO law, but put up big tariffs against stuff that was mined in ways that screwed the people that lived there. And I think if you think of a trade works where whether it's competition or like putting up barriers against things that's bad, and realize that the WTO rules are somewhat complicate that greatly, but I think that if you think creatively how to do it, it would be a good way to deal with the multinationals as like just trying to think about the bottom line in ways that in some cases work together, but in some cases just set up a system so that it makes sense for them to do right there.
It goes from my perspective, it goes back to that disproportionate influence. We're not in the room on those TAC committees. We're not in the room with the U.S. congressperson when they are talking about, or vice president of the U.S. when they're talking about oil energy policy. So it's a disproportionate influence that the corporations have on the political process that makes suggestions like yours, which might make sense, very difficult if impossible to achieve because of that disproportionate influence.
But if you start demonizing people, well, you'll get to talk to the vice president sooner than not.
Demonizing does work. I mean, from our experience, the more you guys demonize people, particularly in the occupational health, we sell occupational services. You demonize an icon off OH&S, they buy OH&S services from us. In fact, we really should be supporting them. It's in our best economic interest. Our experience is that we have multinationals motivated to buy our health services from campaigns against them. I mean, sometimes the campaigns are too small and they ignore them. It's a pretty big company. So if you activists over here, we really don't care. But if it's big and it's on the front pages, we actually use that in our marketing campaigns. Literally, our salespeople go, did you see such and such the other day on the front page of the news? Do you want that to happen to you? No, get a health impact assessment. Get an OH&S audit. So I would say that demonizing to a certain extent does actually work.
Yeah.
And helps us, so feel free to keep
Well, but what I will say, one thing that's fascinating, and Holly can speak more to this than I can as a social movements person, but if you look at the way that the internet is affecting shareholder activism, and if you just look in the past few years at the number of shareholder actions and how close they were to actually passing on social and environmental issues, the win percentage has gone up. And I think that when you think about how ironic it is that it's a private sector technology information that could lead to social movements in this regard, I think that's a real trend to look for in the next 15 or 20 years, because inevitably when you are having to respond to your stakeholders in real time, it makes a big difference than whether you show up in the boardroom.
Well, we've gotten to the official end, although maybe at this time of day it's a little easier. If you want to stay around a little bit longer, but I want to thank the panel. This was an excellent panel, I thought. And thank you. All of you, I hope you saw.